I'll take care of this damned thing myself. By now we could hear the Russian cries distinctly, a huge, continuous ara, ara, ara pobida, muttered the veteran. Just get a little closer. The human wave was now about 400 yards from us. We could also hear the throb of engines, and see three planes, high in the brightening sky. Planes, said the Sudeten. But we'd all noticed them already. Our anxious eyes left the Russian horde for a moment. The airplane engines were screaming, as the planes dived down at top speed. Messerschmitts! Shouted the Stabs. What guts! Hurrah! We all shouted. Hurrah for the Luftwaffe! The three planes were strung out over the huge Russian thrust, spraying it with death. This seemed to be a signal for our mortars to open fire. They were hidden in the brush, and had lengthened their range. The Spandaus which had survived the bombardment began to fire too, while the planes dived down, stimulating our troops to a feverish pitch of courage. I could feel the FM cartridges running through my hand at a dizzying speed. One clip was emptied, and we started another. Some of the big Wehrmacht guns had also opened fire, which must have had a lethal effect on the ranks of Bolsheviks, who were charging as in the days of Napoleon. However, the human tide continued to roll toward us, making our scalps crawl. Only the weight of our helmets kept our filthy hair from standing straight up on our heads, although the idea of death itself no longer terrified us. My eyes remained fixed on the smoking metal of the FM in the steady hands of the veteran. The trembling belt of cartridges moved forward into the machine, shaken as if by a titanic frenzy. Prepare the grenades! Shouted the Stabs, who was firing with his Luger braced on his left arm. It's useless! Shouted the veteran even louder. We haven't got enough ammunition. We can't stop them. Order the retreat, Stabs Feldbull, while there's still time. Our frantic eyes moved from the lips of one man to the other. The Russian war cry, Ara Pobeda, roared closer and closer. The men were firing from their hips as they ran, and the air shook with the rushing flight of their bullets. You're crazy, answered the Stabs. No one can get away from here, and our boys should be coming any minute now, so keep firing, for the love of God. But the veteran had already loaded his FM and picked up the last magazine. You're the one who's crazy. Any minute now is too late. But you go ahead and die right here, if that's what you want. No! No! Shouted the Stabs. The veteran had just jumped from the trench and was galloping toward the woods, bent over as far as he could, and calling to us as he ran. We grabbed our guns in frantic haste. Run! Shouted the Sudeten. We all followed him. For a moment we were almost mad with terror, racing toward the shattered trees with our lungs on fire, while Russian bullets whistled through the air all around us. There were still seven of us, which seemed astonishing. The Stabs had finally followed everyone else, but was still protesting and shouting, Cowards! Shoot back! You'll all be killed! Put up a fight! But we continued to run for the trees. Halt! The Stabs shouted. Halt, you cowards! We had just caught up with the veteran, who had stopped for a minute behind what was left of a tree. I was right beside him. You bastard! The Stabs yelled. I'll report you for this. I know, the veteran said gasping, almost laughing, but I'd take one of our firing squads over Ivan's bayonet any day. We began to run again, climbing a pockmarked hillside stripped of its brush. Aie, howled the veteran, as Russian bullets struck the earth bank with hollow thuds. Hurry, Stabs! Quick! He shouted to our leader, who was still climbing the bank and would never complete his ascent. You'll see. We'll stop them when we get to our lines. The veteran had barely finished speaking when our noncom suddenly cried out and stood up, flapping his arms in an almost comical way. Then he ran back down the little hill and collapsed, with his face pressed into the ground. Damned Stabs, said the veteran. I told him to hurry up. Stripped of a leader for the second time, our eighth group continued its flight through the brush, staggering under our load of weapons. Let's stop for a second, I said. I can't breathe. Hals had dropped to the ground, and was trying to regain control of his breath. Behind us we could hear guns popping, and an occasional German projectile falling toward the east. As if that would stop Ivan, said the veteran. Hasn't anybody told them, for the love of God? Keep moving, boys. This is no time to take it easy. Thank God you were there, Hals said to the veteran, or we'd all be dead by now. Damn right. Now beat it. We began to run again, despite the exhaustion which prevented us from grasping the critical importance of every step. Three other Lancer joined us. You really scared us, one of them said. We thought you were Bolsheviks. We came to a small clearing, which we could see at a glance was not a natural glade but the site of one of our munitions dumps which must have been hit the day before by a Russian shell. We found a few fragments of a pack, but everything else had been burned. A blackened corpse was still tangled in the branches of a fallen tree, some 4 yards above the ground. Suddenly we were surrounded by a full company of soldiers, ready to attack. A tall lieutenant ran to meet us. Sergeant? He said, without wasting a moment. Killed, answered the veteran, pulling himself approximately to attention. Damn, said the officer. Where've you come from? What company do you belong to? 8th Group, 5th Company, Interception Group of the Grossdeutschland Division, Herr Lieutenant. 21st Group, 3D Company, added the three fellows who just joined us. We're the only survivors. The officer looked at us, but said nothing. There was a continuous rumble of guns, and from time to time the shouts of the Siberians. Where's the enemy? Asked the lieutenant. In front of you, Herr Lieutenant, everywhere. They just poured onto the plane, there must be several hundred thousand, anyway. Keep going back. We're not part of the Grossdeutschland. Reattach when you run into one of your own regiments. We didn't wait for him to repeat himself, but plunged into the brush once again, while the officer turned back to his troops, shouting his orders. We passed many other groups ready for the slaughter, finally arriving at the hamlet where we had organized the defense post in the cellar a short time before. We stopped because a unit from our division had settled in there, but no one knew anything about the 5th Company. We were bombarded with questions, first by officers and then by anxious soldiers, but we were also allowed a few minutes' rest in the shadow of a ruined house, and were brought something to drink. Everywhere, harassed soldiers were digging in, constructing defensive fortifications, camouflaging, checking over what had already been done. Toward noon, we could hear the battle approaching. A salvo from the Russian artillery made us run for the cellar we already knew, where we saw a fat soldier, a Grossdeutschland veteran, dancing and singing as the earth and air shook with explosions. His companions paid no attention to him. He's off his rocker, Hals said. He was that way already when we got here, someone else explained. Pretty soon, we too paid no more attention to the fat lunatic who was trying to execute a French can-can. He's too much, Hals muttered. But the madman went right on waving his arms. In the afternoon, 5 or 6 tanks went to meet the Russians, with several groups of grenadiers right behind them. In the distance we could hear fighting, which seemed to go on for about an hour. Then we saw the grenadiers coming back, surrounded by a thick swarm of fleeing soldiers. The woods beyond the orchards were red with fire. Scattered shots were falling all around the gasping soldiers, who were dragging their wounded comrades with them. We realized that in a short time we would again be on the front line. The battle was drawing continuously closer, with its rumbling explosions and loud bursts of sound, and we felt ourselves gripped once again by the essential, inescapable anguish of the front. The counterattacks of the regiments whose positions we had crossed had been swamped, like our tanks, by the irresistible Soviet flood, for whom the most enormous losses seemed immaterial. The hamlet had become an important strategic point, jammed with machine guns, mortars, and even an anti-tank gun, which no doubt was the reason for the hell we suffered during the next 36 hours. Some 60 yards ahead of us, 2 holes had been fitted out to hide 2 spandors, just in front of the ones manned by the veteran and Hals, which we had reinstalled in our position of the day before. To our right, protected by the ruins, a big Jesnaus had been set up and was ready to fire, surrounded by some 50 other infantry weapons, rifles, machine guns, and grenade throwers hidden in the ruins of 4 or 5 wooden sheds, or behind piles of wood, or half-collapsed garden fences. A little further along, behind a low wall, some of the soldiers who had fled were being regrouped and set to digging new trenches. To our left, in a trench beside the only structure left more or less intact, a mortar section had set up its position, swelled by numbers of retreating infantry troops, who were reattaching themselves wherever they could. Further to the left and somewhat behind us, above the road which cut through the hamlet, a 50mm anti-tank gun protected by earth built up into something like a bunker was aimed toward the orchards, and behind it, somewhat lower down, a radio truck had parked beside the tractor for the gun. We had watched the truck arrive while we were resting. An endless stream of orders was pouring from our basement shelter. Officers were regrouping all the fugitives, forming emergency units, and lengthening the line of defense above the hamlet, where there must have been a command post under the authority of a superior officer. From time to time, a bullet fired at random obliged one or another of our groups to dive for the ground. But, compared to what we'd been through the day before, nothing seemed particularly alarming. Only in the distance, about a mile away, violent contact persisted between the last of our retreating troops and advance Russian forces. The veteran nodded as he listened to the rush above and beyond us. "Well," he kept saying, "they're trying to make another Siegfried line up there. Do they really think that's how they'll stop the Ruskies? You, preacher," he turned to a chaplain, "ask your kind God to send us some lightning to help us out. We could use it, since there doesn't seem to be any artillery." Everyone laughed, including the chaplain, who was less sure of his arguments now that he'd seen God's creatures tearing each other to pieces without the slightest trace of remorse. Afeld looked into the shelter. "What the hell's a crowd like this doing in here?" "Interception Group 8, 5th Company, Feldbull," shouted the veteran, gesturing at the six of us. "The rest invited themselves in a little while ago." "Okay," said the sergeant. "Your group stay put. But everybody else out. There are still plenty of holes outside that need to be filled." The other men groaned and got up. "Feldbull," said the veteran, "leave us a couple of extra men to help out, in case some of us are killed. We've got to be able to hold this place." "Okay, but," before he was able to point to anyone, the fat lunatic who'd been dancing when we arrived proposed himself. "I was a machine gunner outside Moscow, Herr Feldbull, and nobody criticized my performance." "You stay then, and that fellow over there. The rest come with me." So our group was enlarged by the fat man, whom we'd nicknamed French Cancan, and a thin, gloomy-looking character. "I beg your pardon," French Cancan said to us. "I hope you'll forgive me for encumbering you with my voluminous presence. You must see that digging a foxhole big enough to take me would be an awful lot of work." He began to talk, enlarging on anything that came into his head. From time to time, an explosion made him fall silent, blinking his little pig eyes, but as soon as the danger was past he would start talking again, more voluble than ever. "You can set your mind at ease about the hole we'll dig for you," said the veteran without a smile. "A few stones on your beer sack, and that'll be it." "I don't drink much beer," said French Cancan. But Hals interrupted him. "Things must be pretty rough outside," he said. "Look, there are two of our tanks coming back." "The hell they're ours," said the veteran. "Those are T-34s, and our anti-tank boys had better notice them." We stared at the two monsters roaring toward us. "God help us," said Hals. "We'll never be able to reach them with these pop guns." He began to fire the heavy machine gun, and a moment later, the tanks were surrounded by flying clods. We also saw luminous impacts on their turrets, which otherwise seemed to be undamaged. Their long tubes, waving and balancing like elephants' trunks, kept moving forward. An explosion sent us down to the floor, and a Russian shell screamed over us, before exploding somewhere beyond the hamlet. The tanks had just slowed down, and the second one was already shifting into reverse. Our Jesnaus was still firing at the two monsters, which were now lurching slowly backward. A second Russian shell hit the left-hand wall of our building, and made the whole cellar shake. There were several other explosions, but we no longer dared look out. Then an exultant shout from outside gave us a moment of courage, and we saw that the first tank, which had been knocked askew by one of our anti-tank guns, was drawing back, zigzagging on a single thread. It bumped the other tank, which wobbled from the impact, and turned, offering its flank to our Jesnaus. A few minutes later, enveloped in a thick cloud of smoke, it joined the other tank, which had completed a half turn, and withdrew. One of them was spouting a thick stream of black smoke, and would certainly not get very far. We could hear all our men cheering. "You see that, boys?" exclaimed the veteran. "That's how to make Ivan run." We all laughed nervously, except the thin, dark boy. "Why are you looking so grim?" Hals asked him. "I'm sick," the other replied. "You mean scared," the Sudeten said. "But that's something we've all got. Sure, I'm scared. But I'm sick too. Every time I have to crap, blood pours out of my ass." "You ought to go to the hospital," said the veteran. "I've tried, but the major doesn't believe me. What I've got he can't see. Yes. I guess a fellow's better off without an arm, on with a big hole somewhere. That's more spectacular." "Try and sleep," the veteran said. "For the moment, we can do without you." A mess truck had arrived at the hamlet, and anyone who had the nerve to go out could get his mess tin filled. The simple fact that we were being supplied restored some of our confidence. We felt that we hadn't lost all contact with the outside world. However, our panic returned at nightfall. The fighting flared up again with renewed violence, and in short order the rest of the German troops were retreating from the Russians, who arrived before the last of the Lancer were able to get through. We could see the oncoming Muzhiks everywhere, outlined against the shattered orchards. They were running toward us shouting, but the noise of our guns covered their voices. A horrible massacre had begun. In the cellar, filled with smoke from our two span doors, the air was almost unbreathable. The noise of the anti-tank gun, which must have been red hot, had enlarged and multiplied the cracks in the ceiling, whose plaster fell onto our helmets like rain. "Let's take turns firing," the veteran shouted to Hals. "Otherwise, the guns will melt." Lindburg, whose face had turned the color of his tunic, stuffed some dirt into his ears so that he wouldn't hear any more. A fifth belt of cartridges was running through my torn hands into the red-hot machine, which the veteran kept on firing. One of the two machine guns in front of us had been knocked out by a grenade. The other was still firing, sweeping across the ranks of Soviet troops, who were piling up in a horrible bottleneck. In spite of their desperate efforts to break through, waves of howling men were dying under our mortar and machine gun fire. We had no idea what was happening beyond our range of vision. Directly in front of us, however, the enemy was taking a terrible beating. Two or three fragments of shrapnel had come through the holes in the wall, but miraculously no one had been hit. Then we heard a heavy rumbling sound, and 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers ducked their heads a little lower. In front of us, among the living and the dead, hundreds of flares lit the darkness. For a moment, we were terrified. Then someone shouted, "It's our artillery." "Thank God," said the veteran. "I'd given up on them." "Okay, boys, we'll be able to stick it out. This means the pop-offs can't get through." The Wehrmacht artillery had finally regrouped, and was pouring down its deadly rain onto the enemy. In the darkness of our smoke-filled hole, our faces lit up with relief. "That's more like it," shouted Kankan. "Look at the pounding those Ruskies are taking. That's how it ought to be. Bravo." In front of us, we could see the earth flying into the air. Lindburg, who seemed almost mad with excitement, was yelling "Sieg Heil!" at the top of his lungs. Evidently the Russians were no better at standing up to our guns than we had been to their waves of assault the day before. The German artillery lengthened its range, and pursued the terrified Russians into the trees beyond the orchards. The arrow, Bobeba, of the Russians had been replaced by the death rattle of thousands of dying men, which filled the air with a horrible sound. "We thought the hamlet had been saved. Let's have a drink," the veteran said. "We really ought to celebrate. I haven't seen such slaughter the whole time I've been in Russia. We should be able to breathe a little easier now. You," he said to Lindborg, pulling him from his corner. "Go find us something, instead of sitting there sniveling." It was easy to see that Lindborg had gone mad. He was alternately laughing and crying uncontrollably. "Get going," said Hals, who was fed up with him. "Run and find us something to drink." He gave him a kick in the seat of his pants. Lindborg went off, holding his head in his hands. "Where will I find anything?" he asked. "That's your worry. At the radio truck those fellows usually have something hidden or anywhere else. Just don't come back with empty hands." Outside, other soldiers were celebrating the rout of so many Popovs. In our cellar, the level of gaiety rose too. Can-Can began to dance again, and we imitated him. For a while there I thought we were finished. "Thank God the artillery stood by us. Thank God is right," laughed the grenadier who'd been with us for 3 days. Tears of joy and relief were streaming from our reddened eyes and running down our blackened faces. The veteran was singing and calling for drink, and we trusted him. He had saved us that morning, and if he was rejoicing, so could we. He knew how the Russians operated, and had already done a lot of fighting. He told us we would have a lull, but he was wrong. The Russian units had grown enormously, and were no longer the crippled divisions which had been shoved out of Poland by the Wehrmacht, and on into Russia for hundreds of miles. Times had changed. Beyond the cellar, beyond the hamlet and its trenches, beyond the thousands of Muzak cadavers and the flaming woods, the Soviet mass was moving into action again, trampling on its own dead and on ours, more powerful than ever, with hundreds upon hundreds of guns wheel to wheel. Soon their cries of victory would drown our laughter. We had become 5 pairs of terrified eyes staring into the murky brilliance of the orchard, which was lit by thousands of dazzling, quick-burning fires. The German lines had already been attacked 3 times by Soviet troops, and 3 times had repulsed them with extraordinary effort and bravery. Between the assaults, the big Russian guns pounded our troops and our artillery, which kept on shelling the enemy as long as it could. For 5 hours already, our laughter had been stilled, as Stalin's organs hammered at our positions, killing many of our defending troops. The rest were either killed or driven mad by bombs. A few, like our group, who had been lucky enough to dig in solidly, went on firing haphazardly with what they had left. Our ceiling had finally caved in, and the hole in the roof acted like a chimney to let the smoke escape. The tall, thin boy with dysentery had taken Hals's place at the Spandau for a few moments. A bullet or fragment of shrapnel had grazed Hals's forehead just below the visor of his helmet, and he was lying down beside 3 dying men who had been brought into our shelter to spend their last moments in relative tranquility. Then Hals's gun jammed, and only the veteran was left firing, stiff with exhaustion, helped by Can-Can, the Sudeten, and me. We felt a crushing sense of despair when Russian rockets erected a wall of white fire over our mortar trench. The Jesenaus had been dismantled, and the anti-tank gunners had given up long since. Only a few Spandaus supported by light infantry guns prevented the howling mob from taking the village. We were threatened with being overrun or surrounded any minute. "I guess we'll have to die now," said the veteran. "Too bad for us, but I don't see any other solution." From time to time, in the light of the flares, we could see the nest of machine gunners in front of us, heroically fighting on. The Russians pressed their attack, bringing on their tanks as soon as it began to grow light, and death to anyone who remained upright. A shell destroyed what was left of our shelter, and sent us all rolling along the floor. Our cries of distress were mingled with the screams of the 2 machine gunners and then the shouts of revenge from the Russian tank crew as it drove over the hole, grinding the remains of the 2 gunners into that hateful soil. Hal stood for a moment, fascinated by the spectacle. He was the only one of us who had remained on his feet, and the only one who could see what was happening. He told us later that the treads worked over the hole for a long time, and that as they manipulated their machine the Russian crew kept shouting, "Kaput! Soldat Germansky! Kaput!" We managed to get out about 10 minutes before the Russians arrived. There was no longer any question in our minds. The rest of our forces had abandoned us. God knows how we managed to drag ourselves through the dead and the chaos and the lights of the flares. Our heads were filled with the sound of continuous explosions. It was impossible even to imagine silence. Hal's was walking behind me, his hands red with blood from a wound in his neck. Lindborg, who had finally fallen silent, was staggering just ahead of us. The veteran was a short way back, shouting imprecations against the war, our artillery, and the Russians. The fat lunatic was beside me, letting off an endless stream of incomprehensible muttering. As the noise of battle grew louder, and the sky brighter, we forced ourselves into a run. "We're finished, Sage," Hal shouted. "We're not going to make it." I began to tremble and to cry with fright. My head hurt almost beyond bearing, aching with the noise of explosions and fusillades. We kept falling, standing up again, and running on, like automatons. Suddenly, Can-Can cried out. I turned my head to look at him through my exhausted eyes, and it seemed as if I were dreaming. I looked at him without feeling, as I moved one foot in front of the other mechanically and with difficulty. "Don't let me fall," said Can-Can imploringly. His hands were clutching his belly, holding in something foul, like the offal on the floors of slaughterhouses. "How can you go on like that?" I asked him, only half aware of what I was saying. Suddenly he cried out again, and doubled over onto himself. "Come on," said the Sudeten in a thick voice like a drunkard's. "There's nothing we can do for him." We staggered on like sleepwalkers. We heard the sound of an engine behind us, and turned to see what new danger might be threatening. A dark shape was jolting rapidly toward us with all its lights extinguished. We summoned up what was left of our energy, and tried to scatter. The half-track, which was almost on top of us, gleamed with dull reflections of the blazing explosions all around it. "Climb aboard, friends," shouted a kindly soul. We stumbled toward the vehicle, which turned out to be the one that had moved the Jesnaus into position above our cellar in the hamlet. Three fellows who had also been in the hamlet had managed to get it started. We pulled ourselves onto the narrow platform, which was almost totally occupied by the heavy, dismantled gun, and the engine started up again, carrying us across a heavily rutted piece of ground which must have been the site of several gun emplacements. The soldiers, standing beside piles of empty ammunition boxes, waved to us as we passed, their faces drawn with exhaustion. "Clear out," our driver shouted to them. "Ivan is almost here." One of the artillery tractors was blazing brightly. Perhaps its flames dazzled our driver. In any case, we plunged nose first into a deep crater, and everyone was thrown out. I think I went through the windshield. I felt a stabbing pain in my shoulder, which was already sore, and found myself doubled over against one of the front wheels of the machine. "Goddamn," someone said. "What are you doing to us?"
"Shut up," shouted the driver. "I think I've broken my knee." I stood up, gripping my shoulder. My left arm seemed to be paralyzed.
"Your face is covered with blood," said the Sudeten, looking at me. "Only my shoulder hurts, though." I saw Hal's lying on the ground. Already wounded, he had been thrown a considerable distance, and was either unconscious or dead. I shook him and called him, and he lifted one of his hands to his neck. Thank God he wasn't dead. Somebody tried to drive our machine out of the hole, but its wheels only dug into the ground and spun helplessly. We walked on to the next artillery position, where the fellows were just pulling up stakes. They loaded us onto trucks along with their gear, and we left in search of a quieter spot. In the distance, the horizon glowed red. "You've come from that inferno?" one of the artillerymen asked.
He was talking to the veteran, who didn't answer because he dropped into a deep, anesthetic sleep.